John R.W. Stott, in his classic work, The Cross of Christ, shares this illustration. It's an illustration of a man visiting a major cathedral, okay? And this is one of my favorite things to reflect on Good Friday, Easter Sunday, something that you've likely heard me share Good Fridays past, Sundays throughout the year. But I love it so much, I'm not going to apologize for reading it again tonight. He says this, and listen, I think it's good for us to actively imagine this, right? Let's put our minds to work here, because this is something that I think is true even now, in our time, in our context, in our culture. So he says, imagine a stranger visiting St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Having been brought up in a non-Christian culture, he knows next to nothing about Christianity. And yet he's more than a tourist. He's spiritually interested. He enters the cathedral and he stands at its central point. He becomes aware that the ground plan of the cathedral is cruciform. It's in the shape of a cross. He walks around and observes that each side chapel contains what looks to him like a table on which, prominently displayed, there stands a cross. He goes downstairs to the crypt to see the tombs of the saints buried there. A cross is engraved or embalmed, embossed on each one. Returning upstairs, he decides to remain in the service, which is about to begin. The man beside him is wearing a little cross on his lapel, while the lady on his other side has one on her necklace. His eye now rests on the colorful stained glass east window. Though he cannot make out the details from where he's sitting, he cannot fail to notice that it prominently and centrally displays the cross. Suddenly, the congregation stands up. The choir and clergy enter, preceded by someone carrying a processional cross. The visitor looks down at the service paper to read the opening words of the hymn. We sing the praise of him who died, of him who died upon the cross. The sinner's hope let men deride, for this we count the world but loss. From what follows, he comes to realize that he's witnessing a communion service and that this focuses upon the death of Christ as the minister speaks to them of the body and blood of Jesus. The service ends with another hymn. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the cross of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his blood. The stranger leaves the cathedral impressed but puzzled. The repeated insistence by word and symbol on the centrality of the cross has been striking. Yet questions have arisen in his mind. Some of the language used has seemed to him exaggerated. Do Christians really, for the sake of the cross, count the world but loss and boast in it alone and sacrifice everything for it? Can the Christian faith accurately be summed up as the faith of Christ crucified? What are the grounds, he asks himself, for this concentration on the cross of Christ? And tonight, many of you might have similar questions. Even just if you're a visitor or a guest, and this is one of your first times in a church in a while, and you find yourself here on Good Friday, certainly you're aware of the many times we've already talked about, sung about, repeated to one another words about the cross. But if you've been with us at Gospel Life for some time, you might have similar questions. And even tonight, you might have more questions as you walk together in a moment down this hall in the middle that, again, like we talked about last week, is in the shape of a cross, and you receive elements at the table like John Stott was talking about in his illustration. And so you might have these similar questions of, is this kind of centrality, the cross of Christ, is it really the case for the Christian, you know? Does the Christian put at the center of their lives the cross? And in what sense is that true? Like, how does that work? Why? Why is the cross so central? And our response to the first part, is this kind of centrality really the case for the Christian? Our response is yes, it must be. And in the text we look at tonight that we've been reading together, that we've heard read for us, we come to see the grounds for it. Because we see the centrality of the cross, that it's the very center of our Christian faith, in three different ways. Three ways the cross is central. That's what we see in the text. And each way that we're going to see tonight will take us further out and further out. So in other words, we're going to begin just very narrowly here in John 19 with our first way. And then the second way the cross is central, it's going to expand out even more from there. We're going to see even more ways that the cross is central. And then in the third way, we're going to see it expand out even more so that by the end we can really say the cross of Jesus Christ is at the center of everything for the Christian life. So first we see the centrality of the cross in the setting of Good Friday, the setting of Good Friday. Okay, and here we really find Jesus' purpose in the world. So the setting of Good Friday, the cross is central. How do we know? Well, we're gonna narrow in tonight. We're gonna reflect upon the three verses that Tracy read, 28 to 30, immediately prior to this. And it begins this way. Verse 28 starts with the words, after this. After this. So we've talked about this before, transitional phrase. But what this shows us once again is that these events are unfolding in a context, in a setting. You know, like, this is a narrative. And so, like any narrative, the events of those narratives, the details that we see in those narratives are unfolding in a setting. There's a context. Okay, so what is the setting? Well, following last week's text, Pilate once again says in John 19, just like he did at the end of 18, he says, I find no guilt in this man. I find no guilt in him. And yet the religious leaders are unrelenting. They're backing Pilate into a corner. And his fear, what we talked about last week, if you're wondering about this conversation that Jesus has been having, going back and forth between the religious leaders on the front stoop and Jesus in the headquarters, inside the headquarters, go back and listen to last week. But this fear that we talked about last week that Pilate has of Jewish uprising, of losing his position, it drives him back into his headquarters with Jesus where he says, he asks Jesus, where are you from? Jesus is silent. And that silence frustrates him further. You know, so he says, you will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you? And authority to crucify you? And now Jesus speaks. Right now that Pilate has brought up this concept of authority, Jesus has something he wants to say. He says, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. You know? In other words, your self-perceived authority is only because this is why I'm here. You think you have control, right? And that authority is granted to you because I've come here to do this very thing. This is what I've come to do. So we have this, another expression, like we've seen throughout John's account, of Jesus' complete control at the cross, the centrality of the cross in his mission, and more evidence of that, right? It's shown further with Pilate seeking to release him continually. So if this isn't at the center of what Jesus came to do, or, you know, if Jesus, maybe it's at the center of what he wants to do, but if he's not in control of it, Pilate could just successfully let him go, right? But Pilate continually seeks to release him. He's attempted to do it twice, offering Barabbas, then flogging Jesus, trotting him out. And both of these attempts have been thrown down. The Jewish religious leaders know that he's over a barrel, you know? They know the soft spot to press in on. The reality that this could cause problems for him, for the appearance that it creates problems for the Roman Empire. So they know they have him, this topic that prompts the most fear for him. They say, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. And so in more irony, Pilate makes this true statement, though he doesn't believe it. He says, behold your king. Right? And he asks them, shall I crucify your king? And the religious leaders of God's people cry out, we have no king but Caesar. There's a rejection of the true king, really in an effort, what are they doing to make themselves king? There's a de-godding of God to make themselves God, right? We see over and over again in the text, the problem that stands at the heart of the narrative is human sin and rebellion against God, this created world order and act of rebellion against its creator. But we also see how Jesus responds to this. They say, we have no king but Caesar. So the text says, listen to this. How does Jesus respond to that? Well, the text says, Pilate delivered him over to be crucified. And you might say, well, that's how the text says Pilate responds to this. But no, remember, following Jesus' remark that the only authority that Pilate has comes from God, we really see who's in control. You know, like the very center of the narrative, the center of the setting of this text shows us this is the very purpose of God. You know, and this is important because there's a way we can read the Gospels and completely miss the center of the story. You know, like as with any narrative, if you miss the center of that narrative at the expense of some surrounding details, you actually misunderstand the story. This is why, you know, there's a way that we could do the Gospel explained badly, and there's a reason why, you know, movie plots explained badly is such a funny phenomenon, right? One of the very few positive reasons to be on social media. Because if you had a friend say, hey, you know, I saw this movie last week. It was super interesting. We should watch it together. And you're like, what's it about? And they said, well, it's about this group that takes about 9 hours to return some jewelry. And then you found out he's talking about Lord of the Rings, right? Or, you know, if he was like, it's complicated, it's complex. This is a complex movie. It's about the culture shock of an orphan returning to the place of his birth and just all of the complexities of an orphan returning to the place of the birth, the culture shock that he goes through, and you find out he's talking about Elf, you know. Or if he's like, you know, this is really about, the best I can explain it to you is the importance of being able to sleep deeply on long flights. And it turns out he's describing Inception, you know. And at first you're going to think your friend isn't very good at watching movies, right? But you'll also know why. You'll know why that's the case. He's getting a lot of the details, right? You know? Some of the details are there. There's jewelry involved, you know? It does, in a sense, need to be returned. But they've missed the point. They've missed the center. And so, you know, I bring that up here because, so in John 19, the details are told in a way that just so clearly surround a central event. And that's important because, unfortunately, there is like a Gospels explain badly phenomenon, because there are many who say, oh, I've read this narrative. You should read it with me. It's super interesting and complex. It's about a Jewish teacher whose words have unintended consequences. And there are many who actually read and describe the Gospels that way. There are many even academics who would say, yeah, it's about this Jewish teacher who said some things that got him in trouble. And it's like, no, the cross is not unintended consequences. And actually, the only way you could come to the conclusion that the cross is an unintended consequence, that it's Jesus saying some things, a Jewish teacher saying some things that ended up getting him in trouble, is if you see the cross as consequential and secondary rather than primary. It's like the reason he came, okay, the center of everything. Okay, so it's the very center of the setting. The cross is at the center of the setting of John 19, therefore it's at the center of John's gospel account. It's why it's Jesus' purpose in the world. It's why he's come. But it doesn't stop there. So we're gonna move out a bit. Look at the rest of 28 into 29. Jesus, knowing that all was now finished, said, to fulfill the scriptures, I thirst. A jar full of sour wine stood there. So they put a sponge full of sour wine on a hyssop branch and held it up to his mouth. And so the cross is at the center of the setting of John 19. These details surround the cross in all of John's account. But also the cross is at the center of the scriptures on Good Friday, all the scriptures. We see a couple of different ways in which this works, and we see a couple of times that Jesus directly mentions it in the text. I've got like 20 minutes tonight, so we're going to pick one. This is Jesus' fulfillment of the word, okay? Because if it's true, you know, if it's true that failing to see the center of a narrative in the Bible makes us miss that, the meaning of that specific narrative, if it's true that we make that mistake enough so that we do miss that meaning, what that also means logically is, if we miss the cross in John 19, if we miss it as central, we miss the centrality of the whole Bible. You know, all of the scriptures. Because here the text says, knowing that all was now finished, in other words, knowing that what he had come to accomplish was now, at this very moment, finally occurring. And I'm going to say more about this word finished in a minute. Jesus said, I thirst. But then the text tells us the reason that he spoke those words. It says, the reason he says, I thirst, was in order to fulfill Scripture. There are a few different, there's some debate about what Scripture in particular Jesus is referring to as fulfilling here, but I'd advocate for the majority view, which is Psalm 69:21. David is writing about his enemies, deliverance from his enemies, and he says, for my thirst, they gave me sour wine to drink. Right. So David is expressing a reality related to his enemies that he's facing. He's asking for God to deliver him from his enemies. And now Jesus quotes that psalm and says, so that's about me. Yeah, David was expressing something in his time, but there's a true and better David, and it's me. And this is important because, like, we just saw an example of what happens if you miss the center of the setting, you know? The gospel's explained badly. But look, for all of us, this is what happens. Like, this is a really good example of what happens when we miss the center of the scriptures, when we're approaching the rest of the Bible. Because, look, we can often read the Psalms, myself included, right? So I'm including myself in this. And we can feel as though, yeah, why, you know, we could read Psalm 69 and we could say, why is God not delivering me the way that he delivered David in the Psalms? Or like, you know, the way that the psalmist throughout the Psalms is crying out for deliverance from his enemies. You know, he's crying out for deliverance. And so we can kind of feel like the world is pressing in against us as believers. And we can wonder, you know, why in this life am I toiling and struggling and suffering? And yet, you know, we come to the Psalms, and don't we find here a promise of deliverance? So how do those two things work together? We see a sufferer in Psalm 69 and a promise of deliverance, yet I'm suffering and I don't experience deliverance. And the answer is because in David, we don't see a picture primarily of us. We are not David. Jesus is the true and better David who defeated the ultimate enemy of sin and death. And he did this at the cross. So this is like, how did Jesus respond to the reality that there's rebellion against the true king? We have no king but Caesar. It's to defeat the ultimate enemy of sin and death, to bear the punishment of our sin, and therefore receive the death that we deserved, that we might therefore be delivered from sin and death. The ultimate enemies, even while we suffer in this life, knowing that our glory is yet to come. You know, like, because of him, because of his work. And not only that, but the purpose in including this here is to show us this isn't just some narrative disconnected in the Bible, or even in addition to the Bible, but rather it's the very center of the Bible. It's the central moment in scriptures. Even in some of these details here, like the sponge being put on a hyssop branch, probably more like a hyssop stalk, is super interesting because the hyssop was used even at Passover to spread blood over the doorpost. I mean, these are images that bring to mind all of the scriptures are pointing forward to what Jesus came to do. So the cross is the center of the setting in John 19. The cross is the center of all of the scriptures. So we can see it here in John. We can see it across all of the scriptures. But now we can zoom out even more and we see The cross is at the very center of salvation history on Good Friday. Jesus finishing his work, finishing his work. So, verse 30, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit. So this is not a description that sounds in any way to be describing someone who's not in control, you know? He said, "It is finished." He bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And so clearly, it's just this repeated theme that he's the one in control and that this is what he came to do. But this word "finished" is so important. It indicates, so it's going to sound obvious. The word "finished" indicates completion. But the kind of completion it's describing is important. Because if you remove this word from its meaning during the first century, it could be taken maybe as a cry of defeat. Like, "I tried, but it's finished." Or it could be taken as a simple earthly declaration that this life is over. Like, "It's finished. I lived my best, and now it's finished." And there are people who take it that way. But it misses the context of this word. I mean, it's so much more than that. So the question is, with this word in particular, what's being completed? Because the verb here, the root of the word that Jesus uses here during the first century, doesn't just mean that something was done, okay, or finished, though it does mean that. It specifically refers to carrying out a specific task. Okay, so in the Jewish religious context of the first century, it had the sense of fulfilling the obligations that you would set out to accomplish, specifically religious obligations, things that you committed to before the Lord. So think about this, given everything we know right now, that this is the center of his purpose, this is why he came, center of the setting, center of the scriptures. What this means is Jesus is not just declaring that his life is finished, but rather that the specific task that he was sent by the Father to accomplish has been finished. It's been carried out, the fulfillment of the scripture, the performance of his Father's will, the eternal decree from before space and time existed to come and die for us on our behalf. And so the reason this matters tonight is because the cross answers the question, how much are you loved? You know, like, listen, hear me out. This is what he came to do for you. We're reminded. The beginning of John 13, which we read, you know, many weeks ago now, but this is right when Jesus is about to recline at the table with his disciples. Verse 1 reads this way. Now, before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, listen to this, having loved his own who are in the world, he loved them to the end. He loved them to the end. And that expression, "to the end," doesn't simply mean the end of his life. It actually is the same root for "finished." Same word, same root of the same word for "finished" that we read here in John 19. He loved them to the completion of a cross. He loved them to the finish of the cross. He loved them to the fullest extent imaginable. At the center of his love for us is the cross. It's the very center of salvation. It's the way in which those who say there is no king but Caesar, those who have rebelled against a good king, can actually be reconciled with that king because he came to bear the punishment that we deserved on our behalf that we might know God. So the original question, do Christians really for the sake of the cross count the world but loss? Like, is there really justification in saying, in describing the Christian faith as the faith of Christ crucified? The answer is yes. By and because of God's grace in Jesus, yes. And so we come to the table together tonight to reflect on this purpose. His body broken, his blood shed. You know, now we make this walk in light of all of this. Now we make this walk as those who throw ourselves on God's mercy by faith in what he's done that we could never do. for ourselves. We come to the table to reflect on what Christ has done, bearing our punishment of death in him that we might have salvation in life. So I want to invite you, if you're believers, come forward, take this cup and take this bread and return to your seats. And in a moment, we'll read through this next section of John 19 and we'll receive this together. I invite you forward.